This opioid crisis is a crisis. I see it every day. It's as bad as they say. It's ruining lives. It's destroying families. Sadly, you know what it reminds me of? Seeing it? It reminds me of us. These white folks look exactly like us during the crack epidemic. You know, it's really crazy to see. And all this shit they talk about on the news about how divided the nation is, I don't believe it. I feel like nowadays we're getting a real good look at each other. It's wild because I even have insight into how the white community must have felt watching the black community go through the scourge of crack. Because I don't care either. Hang in there, whites. Just say no. What's so hard about that?
First of all, I just want to tell you what a great show you got. I listen to you all the time.
Thank you, thank you. What do you want to talk about?
Hey, did I tell you guys I got a coat?
My judgment includes findings of fact and conclusions of law that the state met its burden, that the defendants, Janssen and Johnson & Johnson's misleading marketing and promotion of opioids, created a nuisance as defined by 50 OS Section 1, including a finding that those actions compromised the health and safety of thousands of Oklahomans. Specifically, defendants caused an opioid crisis that is evidenced by increased rates of addiction, overdose deaths, and neonatal abstinence syndrome in Oklahoma. This is a temporary public nuisance that can be abated. Proper remedy for public nuisance is equitable abatement.
Little column A, little column B.
Yeah, baby!
Well, good morning, good evening, or good afternoon, wherever you are, whatever you do. A lot of things happening in the world today. Most of them are far beyond our control, you might say. So perhaps it's time we took a pause and thought about life and thought about the laws of gravity, drugs, opioids, nuisances, politics, and or the news. Don't touch that dial. Just try to hear me out for a little while. Well, the great state of Oklahoma has declared that an advertising campaign that touted the use of opioids was a public nuisance and that it created the opioid crisis. The ruling seems to me to be unlikely to withstand review, mainly because of all the cans of worms it would open up if it did. But weird things have happened. What else is new? Am I right? Here's how you get a hold of me. The text machine is area code 209-565-DAVE. That's 209-565-3283. The email remains dave at thedavebowmanshow.com. And of course, we're on the web. Choose your preferred non-denominational web search browser to take you to plausiblylive.com or thedavebowmanshow.com. Or look for The Dave Bowman Show on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and SoundCloud. Ego Viveri Capulis et Oli Viver. I drink coffee so that others might live. Well, I gotta tell you, it's an interesting subject to get into right now for me because I was asked today what I want for my birthday, which is next month. And while I have millions of answers about things that I would like and things that I would like to do and all of that, the only thing I could come up with today is I would just like a day, one day, that I am completely pain-free, that nothing hurts, I don't like to bitch about things. I really don't. But my life, my quality of life is bad right now. I mean, the pain that I am in is, it's enormous, and it's, of course, all related to the knee, which when you have a knee replacement, when you have knee surgery like that, it messes with your gait, so my back is constantly hurting, my ankles are constantly hurting, my shoulder still hurts from the fall that was caused by the knee caving in. It's getting to the point where there was a time in my younger life, I was on the submarine when it happened, when I first messed up my knee, and there was a little bit of time there where I literally had to set my alarm for about 20 to 30 minutes before it was time for me to get up so that I could take some ibuprofen and some Motrin back in those days so that I could move when it was time to get up. I got past that, but I'm getting to that point now where I live on ibuprofen just about. I mean, it's The pain that I'm in is significant, and it's becoming problematic. It really is. I don't like it. And that's what I said. It's like a day where we just don't hurt. And pain is something that we, in the modern society, we feel like we shouldn't have to deal with it. We feel like pain should be something that we don't have to, you know, we don't need to deal with that, because pain is something that should be something we can deal with. I think about my grandmother who passed away at the age of 53, 54. I don't know. She was young. I know that, younger than I am now. She died of multiple myeloma. And I didn't realize it at the time. I was 13. It wasn't until years later that I discovered how painful that disease is, because people still have it now. But what amazed me about it was, I don't remember my grandmother ever saying anything about how much pain she was in. I don't remember her ever doing that. And sometimes I think I talk too much about how much pain I'm in, but doggone it, it freaking hurts, man. It just does. And I don't know, my legs and my lower back, it's problematic for me. So I watched with some interest, as someone who once upon a time had an adventure with some opioids that I'll talk about here in a minute. I watched with some interest as the state of Oklahoma, my ancestral home, put Johnson & Johnson and Janssen on the advertising company on trial. 2 years they've been arguing about this trial. The trial itself lasted 8 weeks. And over the course of this trial, the position of the state of Oklahoma was that Johnson & Johnson marketed opioid drugs as safe and effective for everyday pain. Did they? I'm not trying to be argumentative here, and I wasn't part of the trial, but I don't ever recall an advertiser or a doctor saying to me that, yeah, take oxycodone for your headache. And I don't ever remember somebody saying that. Now, it's possible that in the advertising that they're talking about, which might have been to doctors, hospitals, whatever, maybe there was some element in there. And I'm sure that if there was, they showed that in the trial. But the object here was, you know, I have never had a doctor say to me ever, yeah, just take this for the rest of your life. This is better than Motrin. This will cure your problem. This will cure your ails. In fact, every time I've ever been prescribed an opiate painkiller of some kind, it's always been when I was in the service, it came with a lecture. And then when I got out of the service, it came with, you know, warnings from my doctor about, you know, be very careful about this. Don't take this for very long. Don't only take it, you know, when you need it. I mean, if you're hurting, take it, but don't just take it because, you know, 6 hours have gone by. If you don't need it, don't take it. When I had my hand surgery, I shattered my left hand in 2001, I guess. Might have been 2002. I'm not exactly sure when, but I shattered my hand playing hockey. It was funny. It was one of the gentlest falls I've ever had in my life. In fact, when I hit the ground, I thought I'd torn up my knee. I got to the bench. My knee was just like, and people were like, oh, are you okay? And I'm like, my knee. And so we iced it down for a couple of minutes. And it's hockey, folks, so you know how this works. When my shift came up again, I went back out. Cut across the middle on a breakaway we had. Took the pass from one of my teammates who threw a great pass with the puck. I turned to shoot, and as I turned and twisted my hand like that to flip the puck, I felt like somebody had stabbed me in the hand with a knife. And I dropped my stick and went down again. I'm like, holy crap. They got my glove off, and they were like, oh, dude, you got to go to the ER. Which was stupid, because the only thing the ER does is take an x-ray and go, can't tell you that your hand is broken in about 8 places. You need to go see your primary care doctor for a referral, but I can't tell you that it's broken. So I did. They sent me to another doctor in Modesto. The other doctor looked at it, said, yep, got to do surgery. And literally, I think a week after I broke it, I was in surgery. When I woke up from the surgery, of course, my hand was like, I mean, it hurt. And they had given me some Vicodin, and I took one Vicodin, and it was probably 20 minutes, and it was like a switch. And my hand stopped hurting, and it never hurt again. And that was the only one I took. I had this whole bottle of like 50 of these things. I took one, and that was it, which is fairly unusual because I'm not pain. You know, I'm not a high threshold pain guy. And so there you go. So I watched, and then of course the knee surgery came up, and let me tell you, when I woke up from the knee surgery, that's me. When I actually, if those of you watching the video, that's me within seconds after I got back to the room after the knee surgery. And what you need to understand is that they had missed the nerve block that they were supposed to do. They changed anesthesiologist like 15 minutes before the surgery. Something got missed, notes got dropped, whatever. They didn't do the nerve block that they were supposed to do. And so you can't really see in this picture, but I'm basically in tears and I'm shaking. And I would have confessed to anything at that point. If somebody had asked me any nuclear secret that I'd have had at that moment, I would have told them. I mean, that's how much pain I was in. And the reason I was in that much pain, and I'm going to warn you here, if you're watching the video and you are easily creeped out, turn away until I tell you to. If you're not watching the video, don't worry about it. The reason I was creeped out was because of that. That's what they had done to me. And so I'm screaming at this point. And of course they come in and realize that the nerve block did not happen. And you can look back now. And so they shot me full of morphine, basically. And let me tell you, within about 20 seconds of the morphine, it's like, oh, I feel better already. I ate dinner that night. And, it was crazy. This opioid painkiller was amazing. And it saved me from enormous pain. 9 days later, when they took the staples out of my knee, I felt like I had been doing really well up to that point. In fact, I hadn't taken very much pain medication at all up to that point. But when she got done doing that, and I'm not sure what happened to this day. I don't really know what happened, but I got up off that table and it was like I hit a wall. I mean, it really was. And for the next, I don't know, probably 3 days, I was flat on my back. I couldn't move at all. And the only thing that kept me going, I mean, the only reason kept me going, I guess I wasn't really going anywhere, were the hydrocodone. I mean, it was crazy. I couldn't move, couldn't do anything. And then, slowly I've gotten better. Now, again, I still have a lot of pain. I'm somewhat distressed by how much pain I'm still in when you get right down to it. But as a general rule of thumb, I'm better-ish than I was. The pain pre-surgery compared to now is much, I'm not going to say it's any less, but it's much different. The pain prior to surgery was just absolutely debilitating. I couldn't walk. But by February of 2016, I could not walk. I can walk now. So does it hurt? Yeah. But I can do it, which I couldn't do back then. So I'm thankful for that. But anyway, the point being that the opioid painkillers were a lifesaver for me. And so I watched this trial with some interest, although not as passionately as I watched some other things. And of course, the state of Oklahoma arguing Johnson & Johnson knew the opioid drugs were addictive and caused harm, and they marketed them as a safe and effective treatment for everyday pain. And that in doing so, this created, in the judge's words, the opioid crisis. In other words, Johnson & Johnson, along with their advertising company, caused the opioid crisis as a public nuisance in the state of Oklahoma, which will cost billions to address. They showed things like this, like the number of deaths compared to the number of opioid sales. And it's kind of they're closely tied. Obviously, the deaths go up as the sales go up. Now, am I willing to accept here that if the sales went down, the deaths would go down? Because there's a couple places there where the deaths do go down where the sales are still going up. So is it necessarily an ironclad proof that just the fact that more people are buying opioid painkillers, that necessarily proves beyond the shadow of any doubt whatsoever that the opioids are in a crisis mode? Judge said that this crisis was a public nuisance, that the state of Oklahoma had proven that it was a nuisance, and that as a nuisance, it needed to be abated. And the way that it gets abated is, of course, money. That's how you abate everything. I don't know if you knew that or not. That's how you abate pollution. You give somebody money. And supposedly then the pollution goes away. That's the mentality, folks. That's the reality of how these things work, is that somehow or another these fines are supposed to then abate the issue. So the number one killer in America, the number one preventable cause of cancer in America, is smoking. Yeah, you know how I feel about smoking. I've made that clear through the years, and I still stand by everything I've ever said about smokers. They're slobs, and it's disgusting. And if you want to do it in your private closed-loop atmosphere, have at it. I don't care. But when you start inflicting it on everybody else, that to me is a problem. I think that smokers are pretentious, and I think that vapors are pretentious assholes. It's what I think. That offends you? Too fucking bad. Get over it. But the point being that smoking, there isn't anybody alive who doesn't know that smoking is dangerous. There's nobody. It's not possible to be alive in the United States of America today and not know that smoking is a health hazard. So when all these people keep buying cigarettes and keep dying of lung cancer or the other emphysemas or COPD or whatever, why is that an epidemic? Why is that a public health crisis? In the big scheme of things. Now, again, I get it. We got to spend money on these, and these people have insurance, and that drives up costs, and I get all that. But at what point, the Navy used to tell us, when the seatbelt laws were first coming into effect, the Navy used to tell us that if you're not wearing your seatbelt and you get into an accident, you're paying for your own medical. If you're a smoker, why should your insurance company have to pay for your cancer treatments? I mean, isn't that a more free market way of handling that? If you're addicted to opioids because of your own issues, and I guess that's where the problem comes in, doesn't it? According to the state of Oklahoma's judgment here, it's not your fault that you're addicted to these opioids. It's the advertiser's fault. The advertisers tricked you into doing this. Now, how long has this been going on? Well, I'm 55, almost 56, and I have never in my life taken an opioid that didn't come with a warning saying, these are highly addictive, be careful. So let's see. First messed up my knee back in 1984. I was 21. I was actually 20 when it happened, but no, I was 21 when it happened, right after my birthday. So, which is a common recurring theme here, isn't it? My birthday. So, given that, that's been at least 25, 30 years, right? That we've been told this. At what point does it become our responsibility ourselves to say, I'm going to use this knowing the risks that are involved and assuming the risks that are involved? Now, look, I'm not heartless. I'm not insane. I understand that this is illness. I understand that addictions are illnesses, not necessarily moral failings. And I get that. Believe me. But I still wonder, at what point how does fining Johnson & Johnson and their advertiser, $534 million, solve that? How does that happen? Are they going to pay for a treatment facility? Is that where this money's going to go? So, no, I'm asking because I don't know. I don't think the state of Oklahoma knows. I think what the state of Oklahoma knows is, yay, $534 million to our budget. Oh boy, what can we do with that? And that's problematic in my view, because that's painful. I mean, the state of Oklahoma looking at this money going, hey, we have a way here to do some things that now all of a sudden we weren't able to do before. Oh, sure, we got to address this opioid crisis, but we're going to address that through legislative processes, aren't we? We're just going to say, you doctors can no longer prescribe this medication for people, and people are going to go, what the hell? You just, look away, exploded my knee. I need this painkiller, and you're going to tell me that I can't have it because you've decided that it's a public nuisance? You look back now. You see what I'm driving at? When I was discharged from the hospital after the knee surgery, we drove straight to our pharmacy because I had a prescription for the OxyContin, Codone, whatever it was. I get them mixed up. and we were told that we couldn't have it. I had a prescription for it in my hand. I had literally on a walker. I mean, I'm, you know, it's, you can't have it. Why can't I have it? Well, because, well, we don't have any right now. Well, when are you going to get some? Can't tell you. What do you mean you can't tell me when you're going to have some? We can't tell you. Because the shipments, I guess, get hijacked by people and stolen and everything else. We went to six pharmacies. Six. Do you know how many pharmacies there are in Manteca, California? Not much more than six. We went to all of them, and then we went to a local, the only one that's locally owned that wasn't a franchise of some sort. They were like, no, can't give it to you. And then my wife happened to turned out to be one of the nurses for one of the pharmacy techs or pharmacists, whatever they were. She was her nurse when she had her baby. And she was like, oh, I know you. We can trust you. And literally the only reason I got it was because my wife was somebody else's nurse. Yeah, we filled the prescription. We just can't tell you when we're going to have it. Never had any more problems getting it filled when I needed it. But I was just amazed at how difficult it was for me, a law-abiding citizen, to get this stuff as it was right then. And this was 3 years ago, long before the opioid crisis such as it is now would deserve $534 million worth of solutions. You see what I'm saying? If a law-abiding citizen who actually needs this stuff can't get it because it's virtually impossible to get, even with a prescription, is it really advertising that's causing a public nuisance here? I have no doubt that people are hijacking shipments of it and stealing it and selling it on the secondary market. I have no doubt of that at all. But is that really being caused by advertising? Is advertising from Johnson & Johnson and their advertiser, this is great for everyday pain. Is that really what's causing that? And who are these people that then turn around and need all this treatment because they're abusing or addicted to these painkillers? Are they getting it from their doctors? Because they're sure as hell not getting it from their pharmacies. I know that. Not unless they're breaking into the pharmacies and stealing it. So where is this coming from? He said, somewhat sarcastically, but knowing at the same time that, you know, the argument is that Johnson & Johnson knew it. They marketed it anyway, and now it's going to cost billions. Well, if you really think that this is going to solve the problem, that's where I fall down on this whole thing. How is this $534 million going to solve this? And we're told that there are more trials away, and this is going to be the first of many judgments that will probably end up in that, you know, trillions of dollars in fines and everything else. And we're supposed to believe then that that will solve the opioid crisis. That it's temporary. See, it's just advertising. If we just take away the advertising, then people won't want it anymore. It's what the judge said. It's temporary. How's that working for the cigarette people, right? Remember they paid those billions of dollars in fines on cigarettes? How's that working out? Did people stop smoking? Has cancer been cured? Has smoking gone away? I don't think it has. I'm pretty sure it hasn't, as a matter of fact. In fact, I'm pretty sure that in some places, around here, it's as bad as it ever was, if not worse. Because now, not only do you have the people smoking, but now you got the pretentious assholes vaping on top of it all. And of course, now we're being told, that's dangerous. Well, those advertisers are probably panicked right now. Crap, we're going to get nailed for advertising this crap. And it's not going to solve anything. They can try to ban it, right? They can say, well, it's against the law. Can't have it. And we know how well that works. So meth is against the law, right? Crystal meth is against the law. Marijuana is against the law. It's working well there. So while I'm not necessarily advocating a libertarian position of legalizing drugs, it's not really what I'm saying here. I am questioning the logic behind this argument that advertising is causing this opioid crisis that necessitates a $534 million fine to be paid to the state of Oklahoma, which is then going to acknowledge the fact that they got the money, sign the check and go, thanks for the money, and our temporary crises is now over. Ta-da! And then what? What happens after that? What happens downstream from there? Oh, they'll probably open a clinic or two here and there. And remember, half the state of Oklahoma is federal territory anyway, so they don't really have to worry about that. So they'll probably open a few clinics here and there. You know, are you addicted to opioids because some doctor watched an ad or got an advertisement in his mail or whatever, in his email, and prescribed to you opiates? And it's the people who sent, and he didn't know no better, because he's just dumb enough to believe advertising too, right? You see my problem with this whole thing? It's all predicated on the idea that advertising, which again is influential, I get it. We live in the era of fake medicine and patent medicine, and we have been for the last 500 years, and I get it. But at the end of the day, am I really supposed to believe that that's the problem? When I can't get the medicine that I need from the pharmacy because they've made it virtually impossible to get, people are robbing trucks to get this drug, is that really because of advertising? And is finding the advertisers really going to stop all that? It's not going to stop the manufacture of it. People are going to figure out how to do that anyway. Even if they ban it, even if they take it away, they're going to figure out how to do that. So, really? Or is this just a giant money grab, just like the tobacco settlement was? See how effective that was, right? Advertisers are shaking in their boots, because you realize that if an advertisement can become a public nuisance, as defined by the judge, where does that end? What's next? McDonald's? What are the things that are advertised on TV, radio, television that could be an issue? It's just something to think about, I guess, for the rest of the day. I got to get going. Take the time right now. Tell the people that matter in your life you love them very much. You'd miss them if they weren't there, so don't pass up those opportunities. You don't want to have that regret. Plausibly Live, I'm Dave Bowman. This is my show, The Dave Bowman Show, right here on the Podcast 99 Internet Radio Network. I'll see you next time, right here. TheDaveBowmanShow.com, Facebook.com/TheDaveBowmanShow. Have a great day, everybody.
The Dave Bowman Show is a Slippery Fish Entertainment production for the Podcast 99 Internet Radio Network. For more information or to complain about how the show offended you, the text or voicemail number is 209-565-DAVE. For more information about the show, log on to thedavebowmanshow.com.
Hey, I'm going to go do something productive. I'm going to go watch television.